Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are Andre Rodatis, Marvin Garwin, and Chuck Thurston. Hi, you guys.
Hey, everybody.
My
compatriots.
Hi, Paula.
My brothers.
Hi, guys.
In spirit. Yay. Hi. And that was the beautiful voice of Annie Zonneveld, who put Rabia's classic poem, the Sufi Rabia, to music. And it's always like just such a happy thing to hear that. And I say a little prayer.
I know.
While we're listening to that. I do too. It's such a beautiful lyrical song. And just a joy. Those Sufi poets, they were amazing. So it's like Gar Jameson told me once, they have such a deep experience of love, Paula. Like, yes, they do,
well,
don't they?
Not only that,
it's amazing.
But it's always good to remind people that Sufi poet was also a woman.
Yes,
back
true.
Back Rafia was, and not everybody knows that. So Annie
right.
was. You know, as you've mentioned many times, you know, that she's a Muslim imam and a female imam, which is a rarity in the Islamic
right.
world. And she's celebrating another wonderful Islamic female who was a leader and a Sufi poet, Rafia. And to me, that's just like awesome.
Yeah, you know, just a quick search of Rabia of Basra. Wiki says the first sentence, often noted as having been the single most famous and influential renunciant woman of Islamic history, Rabia was renowned for her extreme virtue and piety.
Yeah. Renunciant, what does that mean?
I wish I knew.
Well,
renouncing
something. Did she renounce as a Sufi? You know, whatever Sufis renounce, I'm not sure. I'm ignorant of that. If you're a renunciate in the Catholic religion, you would be, you know, maybe poverty, you know, in becoming a monk or something.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense.
Becoming a monk, retreating from some of the normal, from some of the normal obligations and whatever, you know, other involvements in normal life, and becoming a monk in an order of some sort, typically.
Right.
Celibacy, perhaps?
What, Chuck?
Celibacy, perhaps?
Oh, yeah, right. You're a lot of times renouncing something, right? But
that I'm always at the
top
of the
list for some reason.
You know, the sad thing about sexual renunciation for those that are choosing a religious life is that it's self-selecting the heritability of religious predilection out of the gene pool. It's one of the most foolish things that men and women do.
Oh, isn't it, though? Gosh.
Yeah.
I always think about one of Joan Beek's favorite jokes, Joan Beek Evans, who is Crystalline's mom, by the way, for our readers who, you know, don't know that. She's been on the show before, as well as Crystalline's dad, and they're both readers since 1955, having gotten the revelation from Meredith Sprunger. And Joan, one of Joan's favorite jokes was about an old monk who was down in the vaults re-looking at old ancient texts, and the young monk came in and he was crying, and the young monk said to him, "What's the matter, Father? What's the matter?" And he said, "The word was celebrate, celebrate, not celibate."
I love that joke.
I truncated it, obviously.
Now
it's a much longer joke. Yeah, now we find out the word was celebrate. Celebrate.
Mm.
Oh, but we know that's
lost in
true.
Translation.
Yeah, a lot gets lost in translation. And, you know, the first time that I ever really honed in on that, I was 16 again. A lot of pivotal things happened to me when I was 16. Notably, I started studying with the Jehovah's Witnesses. And my whole family was fairly concerned about me. And this guy, again, a man, I've never met him before nor since. We were in a deep conversation about religion, which I talked to a lot of people about religion back then. I think we all did. You know, it wasn't a taboo subject back when I was a teenager. Lots of people were talking about it, and we were sincerely talking about it. And he pointed out to me, this man, that, you know, just one example from the Bible, he was trying to make the point that many ancient translations lose a lot in translation. And you go from an ancient language to a modern language, and, you know, and his point was, look, I'll give you an example. Here's one example from the Bible where just moving a comma one space changed the entire meaning. And so he told me, here's Jesus on the cross. He's talking to the two thieves. In the King James, as I believe it was in the King James's version, he said, it says, "Truly I tell you today, comma, you will be with me in heaven." And he said, in the very common version that most people read these days, it says, "Truly I tell you, comma, today you will be with me in heaven." Now we know that he couldn't be in heaven with Jesus today if we keep reading a little bit. But the whole meaning was changed by moving a comma a single word further. Mm-hmm. And I thought, boy, he really got me with that, I got to tell you. I thought, you know, he's absolutely right. So, you know, it leads me to my dear friend Dwayne Faugh, who's both his father and grandfather were Baptist ministers. And he said every morning, he told me once, he said every morning I had to listen to the Bible being read before I had my breakfast. And he said, being the jokester that he was, now what that meant to me was a lot of cold breakfasts. but he said, you know, he said, I'm so grateful to my father, because he would say often, many people read this version of the teaching in this Bible, and I like that, but I prefer this one. And he would read another interpretation. This one makes more sense to me. And Duane said he grew up knowing that, you know, different translations could be vastly different, even though they were covering the same material. And he learned to, you know, decide for himself which one was the most meaningful. So I appreciate that. And we had a great conversation going right before we went on the air, too, about, and since we've been studying the ascending sons of God and the possibilities that lie before us in life eternal, our eternal career, as the Arantra book loves to call it, we were talking about, we have some dear friends who had parents who were atheists. And one of our friends lost her parent just recently, and her parent was an atheist. And so she's questioning whether atheists ascend. And, you know, those old teachings, all those old conflicting teachings. And so...
Well, you know, it kind of goes to show, Paula, you were talking about translations of the Bible and loss of interpretive points of view on the material. It's really interesting. You know, we have these bodies of revelation or claimed revelation, and of course, anytime you do a translation, you're introducing all kinds of human points of view, and which are interpretations,
right,
and subjective. But even with what we have with the Arantra revelation, we've done our best to really keep integral the material as it was given to us from our understanding from higher celestial sources pretty directly. Even there's all of this room for interpretation and trying to understand the implications of the material. And I would say this question is probably one of the most discussed questions in study groups over the decades that I've been involved. I think
you guys would agree,
is who gets to survive? What are the criteria for survival? And which makes perfect sense, because it's such a critically important issue and so personal, you know, for each one of us, not only for us individually, but, you know, family members, people we care about. And this issue of, you know, what is your theology? What do you believe? Do you believe there is a God? Do you believe there is not a God? How is that affected by the theologies of the culture that surrounds you? You know, what are you actually rejecting? And what are the criteria for moving from this life into the next life? And having the chance to see what is really going on and make your choices in a fully informed way, which I think the revelation is very clear. You know, saying that everyone will have a fully informed, conscious choice available. But you know, you guys were talking about this conversation about atheists. And hold on a second. Sorry about that. So the, you know, one of the thoughts that comes up for me is the places, multiple places in the Arantra book, where they say that a person can be following the leading of the thought adjuster consciously or unconsciously, and I think there are at least two locations where they say that. And you know, what does it mean to follow the leading of the thought adjuster unconsciously? And I've thought about that. And I think an atheist, and I knew one who was a wonderful fellow, served his life all life long in good causes, was a dedicated human being, a loving and considerate human being, passed on in his 80s. He was, in fact, the past president of the American Humanist Association, was an attorney here locally, and Mill was his name. And I'm convinced that these people are following the still small voice. They don't label it God. They don't theologically mm-hmm. understand it as God. And that to me means that they're following the leading of the indwelling spirit, but they're not conscious of what that spirit is, and they're not consciously pursuing it as God as such. But functionally, they're following the spirit, and they're trying to live lives that are good, true, and beautiful, which are godlike values.
Right.
And I'm really quite convinced that anyone who is following that leading consciously or unconsciously will survive into the next life and be given full opportunity and surroundings and education and support and information, et cetera, such as we have, to reach really integral conclusions. So anyways, those are just some initial thoughts. But you guys were saying, sharing mm-hmm. some of your thoughts as well about that question.
Well,
it's such a powerful question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think faith has a lot to do with it, too.
Yeah.
Maybe more than belief. I'm not sure. But from what they describe about the soul, like our soul captures our kind of our character patterns, our decision patterns, our characteristics, you know, not so much our beliefs, but more our behavior in a sense, I think, and how that is conditioned and developed over time. And then that's rejoined with our memories from the adjuster. But faith, I think, has a lot to do with evolving the soul, even if the beliefs in your mind are either, you know, are extremely undeveloped, as they might be in some cases, where people have rejected, like you were saying, Paula, where they've rejected institutional religion for a variety of reasons. But yet, in a way, I mean, you have to make your way through life, so a combination of some kind of maybe unconscious faith. I'm not even sure what the word would be. But that, like you're saying, Marvin, that feeling of inner guidance is in play, and the person is responding to that. And that may have been part of what turned them away from religion, looking for something more personal and original, you know, within. And
less
all
judging.
All those things. yeah, all those
less
lines
judgmental.
Of development in a human being, I think, are, you know, are have value and will be preserved to be continued in their development. But particularly there's faith involved, because faith is what makes you do things you might not otherwise do, right? Where you escape the patterning of external influence. And that's, you know, Jesus talks
good
about
point.
You know, taking initiative and originality. I think that's maybe why faith is so important, because if you're completely patterned by external reality, there's really nothing there that's original of yourself, or very little. It doesn't mean you won't survive, but certainly the more you can create that's original to yourself, you know, the expression of that inner spirit, I think, the greater the chances.
Well, you know, I'm so glad you mentioned faith, Chuck, because, you know, it's just there's an interesting part of this discussion that always hinges on faith. And when our friend asked this question, she asked it of a list, do you think atheists go to heaven? And she's spread the teachings as long as we have. You know, she's a student of the teachings, in most sincere student of the teaching. And, you know, she's sincerely wanting to know what we all think on this particular list that she asked the question. And when she asked it, I thought, you know, I want to say something, you know, meaningful. And a lot of people, you know, said a lot of things about it. And I went and looked up, you know, what came to me was what Jesus said in my mind, the story of what Jesus said to the condemned criminal. And so I went and read that again. And I thought, yeah, because here's this guy, you know, for all intents and purposes, he has not lived a godlike life. He's a criminal. He's a condemned criminal. How many of us would go, A, and even minister to condemned criminals? You know, that in itself would, you know, how he came to be in the presence of a condemned criminal, the book doesn't really say, but, you know, just that he was. But even so, by all intents and purposes, you would think that someone who is condemned is, you know, not a savory kind of individual, maybe not a person who practices any belief at all in anything true or noble or good or beautiful. And so I thought that might be, you know, poignant to illustrate. So I went and found it, and here it is. I'll read it. It's from paper 133, section 4, paragraph 12. This is when Jesus was traveling through Rome with Gonad and Ganad before he began his public ministry. This is his private ministry, which, of course, everybody cherishes who reads these things. They're just so packed full of beautiful statements from Jesus. And he says to the condemned criminal at the last hour, "My brother, you have fallen on evil times. You lost your way. You became entangled in the meshes of crime. From talking to you, I well know you did not plan to do the thing which is about to cost you your temporal life. But you did do this evil, and your fellows have adjudged you guilty. They have determined that you shall die. You or I may not deny the state this right of self-defense in the manner of its own choosing. There seems to be no way of humanly escaping the penalty of your wrongdoing. Your fellows must judge you by what you did, but there is a judge to whom you may appeal for forgiveness and who will judge you by your real motives and better intentions. You need not fear to meet the judgment of God if your repentance is genuine and your faith sincere. The fact that your error carries with it the death penalty imposed by man does not prejudice your chance of the chance of your soul to obtain justice and enjoy mercy before the heavenly courts." And again, I stumbled on that word faith, and that's an interpretation. So here's a question for all of you guys. Can a person be following the unconscious leadings of the thought adjuster? Can a person be kind and, you know, loyal to truth, beauty, and goodness? And is that faith? Or is faith something else?
What was the adjective they used with it? Sincere?
Sincere faith, yeah. If your
sincere
faith is sincere, if your yeah, repentance is genuine and your faith sincere.
There you go.
Then
yeah, I think
you
that's
need
an
not,
important qualification.
Well, then, you know, and I obviously didn't share this quote again because I thought, well, you know, there you go again. It's an interpretation. What is faith? What is sincere faith? And I'll add one more thing. I had a conversation with a fellow that's studying the Urantia book with us on Tuesday night. And he sent me a message and he said, "I wish I had your faith." And I wrote back to him and said, "You know, it seems to me like you have great faith in all that is true and beautiful and good." And he, you know, he shares with me a lot of things over email in different places. And so, you know, I know his heart. And he is totally dedicated to truth, beauty, and goodness. But he wishes he had my faith. You know, and it just struck me when he said that. I'm like, wow, why would he say that? When he appears to me to be such a man of faith. So, you know, what is that quality that they see, that the universe sees? And I fully believe that, you know, and a lot of the things that have come out in the discussion is, you know, that we're having on this list is, you know, you get a chance to go on and be faced with truth and not with religious error and concepts that are so, you know, repugnant, really. Concepts about God the Father that are so repugnant that you rejected. Maybe that makes you a hero and not a person of little faith. Maybe because you have that much faith in truth that you are able to reject falseness, that makes you heroic. And I don't know. It's just an interesting interesting how to interpret these things.
Yeah,
well, I have a question. I have a question related directly to the passage you read, Paula. So obviously this fellow was in jail. He was about to be executed and, you know, for his crimes. And Jesus came and ministered to him in a remarkable way. And I'm my guess is you'd all agree that if Jesus had not happened to come to him and minister him and explained and shared all of these things and all of these perspectives in the way that he had, this fellow would have passed on without any of that, without understanding any of that, without understanding the choice for repentance, etc.
Right.
Because
the benefits.
Because what Jesus could provide was remarkable because of who he was. And what an amazing opportunity this individual had to turn around and move in the right direction. But I have to believe that all of the motivations and subtleties of situation that Jesus ascribed were part of his situation in that moment, regardless of whether Jesus had come to him or not, right? And if he had passed on without that ministry, my question is, do you think he would have received the equivalent of that ministry? He would have been resurrected and received the equivalent of that ministry in the next life, so that the same opportunity that Jesus offered him before he died would be offered to him in the next life. I have to believe the universe, being as focused on mercy and a full understanding of the antecedent factors in anyone's situation, would offer him that opportunity and not say, well, Jesus didn't have to come to him, so too bad for him. You know, I have to believe that they would have offered the same kind of opportunity to everyone, and Jesus was the instrument of it. But I think there are countless celestial instruments of sharing those same perspectives immediately upon reawakening to help a person navigate those incredibly subtle transitional choices. That's my conclusion. It's obviously we're in the realm of wondering and speculating and thinking, but that makes sense to me.
And I guess that response is about your faith. You know, you've taken it on faith, really, based on what you know from the amazing teachings of the Urantia book, that mercy, I think Andre said this in our conversation before we went on air, mercy will trump, you know, love and mercy will trump everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and the love of a parental love is the ultimate sort of governing principle, I think.
Right.
So
if
you think of yourself as a parent, you know, God is a parent, you want your children, you know, we've all been parents, you want your children to survive, right?
Sure.
You don't want anything to guarantee that happens.
The book says uncategorically that he is willing that none should perish. None.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it further says that each one of us is, you know, without duplicate and infinity and irreplaceable in all eternity. So he can't recreate the unique and beautiful creature that each one of us is, with the potential that each one of us has, cannot be recreated. He is willing that none should perish. So that, you know, I guess we have to have faith in that.
I think it takes some conscious determination not to survive. I mean, to reject.
Right. Right.
A relationship with God in reality, once you know what it means. you know, that would take a very positive decision. I mean, not positive is the right word, but a very definite decision to bring about your own death. You know, it's like cosmic suicide in a sense.
Right, right. I've talked to a lot of Urantians about this, as Marvin pointed out, and I think this is the crux of all religious belief, really, if you want to know the truth, is this concept of survival, of living on after dying.
Yeah.
And
Well, you know what?
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, what Jesus would always say about that is you can experience that now. You can experience survival now.
Right.
And then, you know, get on with work without holding that over your own head as a question. But,
right,
of course, that takes the understanding that he offers and the faith that he offers.
Isn't there a place in the book it would be better to just assume that you do? Isn't there a statement to that effect? Yeah. Assume that you're going on. Be prepared. Go, you know, make your life count. You know, it's like I told somebody once, spend your life. Don't waste it. Spend it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Don't let that question take away from living your life now.
Right, right.
Experience survival in every moment.
Right.
You know, that's what's kind of so thrilling about it. But I had this quick little sort of a strange thought that came up in my mind when you were talking about faith and belief, that those two qualities, characteristics, whatever you want to call them, they're, if you reverse them, it reveals, I think, an interesting meaning. If you talk about faith sincerity, in other words, sincerity characterized by faith, to me that's kind of a helpful thought, because real sincerity does require faith, I think. In the
good
same
point.
So faith, you know, we have sincere faith, of course, we want our faith to be sincere, but I think in terms of a survival characteristic, if our sincerity has faith behind it of some kind, you know, that willingness to step out into yourself, then, you know, that creates the opportunity for the adjuster values to come into play. Anyway, I don't know, maybe that's just me, but I thought that idea of faith sincerity, you know, as you mentioned, it has to be hyphenated words, you know, like worship wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
faith,
you know,
sincerity,
what?
To me, hit something in my understanding that, sincerity really is an act of faith sometimes.
I love that point. And I think that, you know, one of my, just a cherished quote for me in the Urantia book is that one that says, great things happen not only because people believed in Jesus, but because he believed so much in them. You know, I just love that.
Well,
because
you can feel that.
You can feel that. And that is, to me, you know, the faith, trust in the goodness of God, the God that lives within us all, right? That every person somehow wants to do the right things. You know, in the core of their being, they're striving to do the right things, and that's God in them. You know, that striving, that's God. That longing, that inherent desire, like the book tells us, curiosity, the dread of monotony. You know, these things aren't put here just to aggravate and annoy you in your short lifetime, but rather to suggest to you that this life is just the beginning of an endless voyage of discovery. Those things, you know, I guess we can, you know, even if we haven't heard those amazing and beautiful words of truth in our lives, we can hold on to an inner confidence that goodness will triumph. And that most
I think the Holy Spirit contributes to that.
Yeah.
You know, when we have people, you know, before we break through into these more conscious levels of spiritual development, we're always supported, I think, by the Holy Spirit in ways that are kind of mysterious, but they say that the influence of the Holy Spirit acts independently of our decisions sometimes. that it's our bedrock spiritually as a circuit, as a spirit circuit, you know, that lives on top of the edge of the mind spheres, or is enabled by it in some way. So I don't think that influence should be discounted in terms of these survival reckonings.
Right.
You know, it's like having a conscious, quote, belief in God is more like an adjuster contact thing, maybe. But prior to that, you could have the kind of qualities of character you've all been talking about. Mm-hmm. You definitely have survival mm-hmm. values that are probably sponsored by the Holy Spirit.
And ultimately, you're a child of God, whether you know it or not, right?
Right.
Whether you know it or not, the reality is you are.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. You have value, whether you know it or not. Well, thanks, you guys. That was good. You know, it was on my mind, and I appreciate you talking about it because of our dear friend who's grappling with this upon the loss of her atheist mother. And and many of us have grappled with
these. We need some more data about her mother, I
think. Yeah.
It turns out yeah.
Well, it's like I told her, I don't think anybody who didn't have a deep,
her family.
Deep...
Yeah. You're right.
How could somebody...
Mother, she's got to be something cool about her.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point. If her mother raised her, there's something going
yeah,
on there.
Right, right.
Really
she can't be all
bad. Spiritual. Right, right, exactly. Okay, so, well,
yeah.
We are... You know,
well,
Andre hasn't
Paula,
seen...
I just...
No,
I
one more
wondered,
thought?
I
sure.
Wondered, no, I just wondered if Andre had any he hadn't
well,
really...
He hasn't said
thoughts.
Anything,
well,
but I know that he's trying to get some work done, that there was an emergency come
okay.
up. So he might be
Sorry.
Preoccupied. I don't know for sure.
Got
Andre,
it, got
are
it.
You...
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
He
I
is.
I don't know. He
is a
he
little
is.
Preoccupied, but you know, it's a fascinating discussion, and... thanks for just recapping, you know, mercy trumps everything. That,
yeah.
You know, the ancients of days make final pronouncements on the judgment of souls.
Mm-hmm.
But long before something gets up there, there are all kinds of merciful mandates for most of us that get weighed in on, and it's clear what they want. It's clear what they would rather do in the universe. They want us. They want every last one of us that wants to live in reality, that has the least little ability to grow in love.
Mm-hmm.
They know this universe. For anybody that is well motivated, that has love in their heart, will bring them along. Anybody
mm-hmm.
can, heck, if they can bring me along, they can bring anybody along. That's all I got to say.
I live by that philosophy, actually.
you're a good witness for the rest of us.
Yeah, well, thank you, Andre. That was great. Nice cap off of that conversation. Thanks for bringing it up, Marvin. So if Andre's quiet, we'll know that he's working on a problem that
I'm
might take his
concentration. I'm just finishing up here, but I'm paying attention.
Okay, good. That's good to know. Great. Okay. So we are starting a new paper this week, paper 35. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm in the wrong paper. Help me out here, guys. Paper 31. I picked the wrong one. When I was looking at the table of contents, I just grabbed the wrong paper. So we are starting a new study on paper 31, the core of the finality. And this was just, this kind of came about spontaneously because as we did the Ascending Sons of God, on the last episode, we had some just great references, cross-references to this paper, The Core of the Finality, which is the ultimate destiny. I don't know if you could call it the ultimate destiny, but it's one destiny of finaliters or the ascending sons of God. So we as ascending sons have this destiny to belong to the core of the finality, especially if we are father fused, and maybe exclusively, I guess you could say, if we are father fused. And so we decided right there to graduate to this paper. And so we're working our way backwards through the talk. We were on paper 40, and now we're on 31. We're backtracking. But that's okay. We're not, you know.
This
don't
is what
stay
we should have
formality.
Done.
Yeah.
Before we read paper 40.
That's true. But maybe we can reflect. I'm sure we'll reflect forward, right?
No doubt. 40. And backwards.
Yeah, no doubt. Forward and backward, as we like to do. So this is the beginning of, we're lighting this candle now on paper 31, the core of finality. And who wants to read that first section? It is a pretty long section for a preamble, but do you,
I can read
Chuck?
It.
Okay, cool.
Sure. Yeah, why not? Okay. Paper 31, the core of the finality. That has a sound of finality about it, you might say. Okay. it sounds important. You know
it
I mean?
Sounds important, doesn't it? And well, it
yeah,
is.
Yeah. They talk about like final values, final this, final that. So this is the core of finality. The core of mortal finalizers represents the present known destination of the ascending adjuster-fused mortals of time. But there are other groups who are also assigned to this core. The primary finaliter core is composed of the following. 1, Havona natives. 2, gravity messengers. 3, glorified mortals. That would be us. 4, adopted seraphim. 5, glorified material sons. 6, glorified midway creatures. These 6 groups of glorified beings compose this unique body of eternal destiny. We think we know their future work. When they talk like this, we think we know their future work, but we are not certain. While the core of the mortal finality is mobilizing on paradise, and while they now so extensively minister to the universes of space and minister the worlds settled in light and life, their future destination must be the now organizing universes of outer space. At least that is the conjecture of Uversa. So the talk going around Uversa is that we're going to end up in outer space someday.
Move over, Jeff Bezos.
It's funny just imagining the reality of what you're describing. Anyway. The core is organized in accordance with the working associations of the worlds of space. The core is organized in accordance with the working associations of the worlds of space and in keeping with the associative experience acquired throughout the long and eventful ascendant career. All the ascendant creatures admitted to this core are received in equality, but the exalted equality in no way abrogates individuality or destroys personal identity. We can immediately discern in communicating with the finaliter whether he is an ascendant mortal, Havona native, adopted seraphim, midway creature, or material son. During the present universe age, the finaliters return to serve in the universes of time. They are assigned to labor successively in the different super universes and never in their native super universe, until they have served in all the other 6 super creations. Thus may they acquire the sevenfold concept of the Supreme Being. Mm. Talk about an assignment. Wow. One or more companies of the mortal finaliters are constantly in service on Urantia. There is no domain of universe service to which they are not assigned. They function universally and with alternating and equal periods of assigned duty and free service. Equal periods of assigned duty and free service. We have no idea as to the nature of the future organization of this extraordinary group, but the finaliters are now wholly a self-governing body. Kind of like the Melchizedek. They choose their own permanent, periodic, and assignment leaders and directors. No outside influence can ever be brought to bear upon their policies, and their oath of allegiance is only to the Paradise Trinity. Wow. The finality
autonomy.
Yeah, we'll talk about maybe why that might be the case. The finalers maintain their own headquarters on Paradise, in the super universes, in the local creations, in the local universes, and on all the divisional capitals. They are a separate order of evolutionary creation. We do not directly manage them or control them, and yet they are absolutely loyal and always cooperative with all our plans. They are indeed the accumulating tried and true souls of time and space, the evolutionary salt of the universe. And they are forever proof. They are forever proof against evil and secure against sin. They are forever proof against evil and secure against sin. Interesting phrasing.
So that's
there.
That's what the ascending sons have earned. They've earned that, just like Michael earned his sovereignty and supremacy in Nebadon.
Mm-hmm.
We will, going the opposite direction that he went, you know, because he descended. We will ascend. All the way to paradise, be embraced by the Trinity, become mustered into the core finality, and have earned this form of supremacy where nobody questions us.
Well,
to me, that's just astonishing, really.
Well, you know, think of the fact that we're fused with it. Fragment of God, and that that's reached some kind of level of realization that makes us, I mean, we don't become personalized testers are different, but in a way similar, that we've given personality to a fragment of God, and God is, that fragment has given divinity to us. And it makes sense that we wouldn't answer to any lower level of universe nature below our source. I mean, doesn't that kind of make sense?
It totally makes sense. But my point was only that we earned it. You know,
we did earn it. And who knows what that's going to entail. It requires all the way through Havona, which is fascinating to consider.
Right. Well, the detail of the whole journey is pretty, you know, stringent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like that. It's no easy thing. It's no easy thing. But we earn it.
Yeah.
And it's something to – and I want to point out that this paper, interestingly, is written jointly sponsored by a divine counselor and one without name and number, authorized so to function by the Ancients of Days – on Uversa. That's interesting to me. So many of the papers in the Urantia book don't have they have one author. And they don't say something like that they're authorized so to function in this capacity to write this paper by the Ancients of Days. That went this paper went pretty high up.
Yes. That's really interesting detail.
Well, it's what's very interesting about it when you think about it, is that, number one, it's being co-authored by an author that has divinity, you know, paradise divinity, the Trinity as its source, and by another one that is a trinitized former member of the core of the finality. Remember, all trinitized sons are finaliters before they're trinitized.
Mm.
They take the finaliter oath, and then they are, you know, trinitized some point later. We don't have timelines on that, but you can bet that they don't just take the finaliter oath and they say, okay, now run along, here we go, we'll trinitize you now. They probably do a good long stint as finaliters. And what I would suspect, I mean, I don't know this, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. You know, where they talk about the fact that the core of the finality serves in the other six super universes ere they ever go back to their super universe of origin, which tells you that each core, you know, is made up of members that all hail from the same super universe other than the ones that hail from the central universe, right? Because otherwise that would be illogical. And they will, I think that would be extraordinarily important not to be deprived of that experience, even though trinitization could make up for that, that the Trinity could make up for the divinity aspects of that, moving them up to seven-stage spirits. They couldn't make up for the lack of experience. And I don't think they would try to deprive them. So I wonder if that, I know this is quite a departure, I apologize. but the that one with without name and number probably has served for a good long while in the core of the finality. And therefore, even though finaliters are not allowed to be part of, you know, directly part of a revelation like this, the fact that we have mighty messengers and one high in authority in one paper and this one without name and number in this paper allows for finaliter experience to be coming into play as well as prior mortal experience. Anyway, I'd be curious what you think about that idea that trinitized members, that's a departure. Let's not get too far away. Anyway.
Well, you know, as always, I mean, I love to just go look up what one without name and number represents.
Yeah.
And
amazing.
Interestingly, it only comes up three times in the book, at least written that way, one without name and number. And it's based on what you're saying, Andre, it's interesting what they say in relation to that. In paper 19, they say, paper 19.3.7, it says, seven divine counselors in liaison with a trinitized evolutionary trio, a mighty messenger, one high in authority, and one without name and number, represent the nearest super universe approach to the union of the human viewpoint and the divine attitude on near paradisical levels of spiritual meanings and reality values. Such close approximation of the united cosmic attitudes of the creature and the creator is only surpassed in the paradise bestowal sons, who are, in every phase of personality experience, God and man. And I know this is a rabbit hole, but it's really intriguing. And then in... In paper 22.4.6, it says, this group of sons is chiefly, but not wholly, concerned with the services of the ascendant career of the time-space mortals. If the viewpoint of a mortal creature is ever endowed, the question is settled by appeal to an ascendant commission consisting of a mighty messenger, one high in authority, and one without name and number. And then the third reference is the one that we just, you know, that I just cited at the end of this paper. We're mm-hmm. reading paper 31, which is, it was jointly sponsored.
There's a whole section about them in paper 22.
Yeah.
Okay.
That paragraph you read was the sixth.
Well, you know, I have a little
section.
Those without name and number. Okay, it refers
right,
to them as
right.
those. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I have a little puzzle, and it's probably my lack of knowledge, really, because I trust your sense of the details, Andre, much more than I trust my own. Mighty Messengers, one high in authority, in my recollection, and those with one without name and number, are ascended mortals who ascend and are trinitized, and the Mighty Messengers are rebellion tested. My recollection is one high in authority is one who has unusual administrative or executive abilities, and one
Correct.
Without name and number were outstanding in terms of their capability of worship, their worshipful nature. But my recollection was that they were Trinity embraced and did not join the core of the finality. So my recollection is a little different from yours, you're probably correct.
Yeah, well, it's easy to overlook. Number one, it's like it's so far out that in the firmament, basically, that from a human perspective, it's two-dimensional. Are they there for a few years or a few million years or a few billion years? How do we know? And what does that mean? But the other thing is that the references to that are so, you know, almost like off the cuff. It's almost a matter of they're not emphasizing
well, 15,
it, but it's there. It's there to be paid attention
15,
to.
10, 12.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, I just looked that up too, Chuck. That's interesting.
Gives a little detail.
Yeah, go ahead, read it.
Okay. So they say the remaining three orders, Mighty Messengers, those high in authority, and those without name and number, are glorified ascendant mortals. The first of these orders, that would be the Mighty Messengers,
mm-hmm.
the first of these orders came up through the ascendant regime and passed through Havana in the days of Grand Fonda. Having attained paradise, they were mustered into the core of finality, embraced by the Paradise Trinity, and subsequently assigned to the supernal service of the Ancients of Days. Now, does that refer to all of them or just the Mighty Messengers?
Well, it says the first
anyway,
of these three orders.
All would.
These three orders.
It wouldn't make sense for the others to be excluded.
Right.
And then they say, as a class, these three orders are known as Trinitized Sons of Assignment, being of dual origin but now of Trinity service. This thus was the executive branch of the super-universe government enlarged to include the glorified and perfected children of the evolutionary world. Executive branch of the super-universe government.
And that's Trinitized Sons of Attainment. You said assignment, but yeah, it's attainment.
Oh, sorry, yeah, Trinitized Sons of Attainment.
As opposed to selection on the one hand.
Right, right.
And then...
Right,
class.
It's an achievement. It's an attainment, right?
Right.
That's a little ambiguous.
We've gone down this rabbit hole, I am interested in your points of view in terms of, you know, do you think these individuals are part of the core of the finality for any length of time before they are extracted? What is your thought about that? Because I think that's an interesting place of speculation. This is where I would, I have an opinion, but it's just opinion because we really don't know. But you know, it would be reasonable to suppose that experience in the other six super universes, especially since all of them are going to be
you know, trinitized in a group of either 700,000 for mighty messengers or 70,000 for those high in authority or 7,000 for those without name and number, and then apportioned 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 to each of the super universes so that all the super universes have equal numbers of these trinitized suns. Okay? These trinitized mm-hmm. suns of attainment are there in all super universes, regardless of their level of progression, in equal numbers. And it would make sense to me, as another aspect of it, that they would, in order to, I mean, do they have any choice as to where they're put? Even if they didn't have a choice, even if they were assigned, it would seem that in order to make an informed choice, you might want to serve in those areas beforehand. So that's just some of my thinking.
Yeah. Well, along those lines, I would assume or at least expect that the acquiring the sevenfold concept of the Supreme Being would have to precede the Trinity embrace, because the sevenfold concept of the Supreme is an expression of the Trinity, you know, the seven combinations and permutations of three.
Right.
So that experience,
at least
as
to
a
have
finality,
an experiential.
In
mean,
all
you could
the
get
seven
it
universes, right?
Yeah.
Right.
You
but
could get it existentially through the Trinity embrace, but you can't get it experientially except through experience.
Exactly.
We're told
that
in no uncertain terms. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Which is why I think we would have to bring that to the Trinity embrace for that to be a true human divine synergy, partnership.
So imagine the eons, you know, post-finality, pre-trinitization that might be involved.
Right. In that sentence, it sounds like, oh, they did this and then they did that. But
yeah.
It could be that there are long stretches of time between those two phrases.
Probably is.
Right.
Interesting. Interesting stuff.
Yeah,
this is
interesting to notice that.
Uh-huh. Great preamble to this paper, and what they say, you know, everything they say in here is just so intriguing to me.
I did have a couple of things from what we read that are really also interesting.
Yeah, go ahead, Marvin.
Let's see if I can find it. Well, that in the paragraph number 8, we think we know their future work. While the core of the moral finality is mobilizing on paradise, and while they now so extensively minister to the universes of space and administer the world set in light and life, that's interesting. That kind of caught me, that they actually administer. So they're very active in the ages of light and life in the administration of the world. It makes me wonder whether they're rendered more visible at times to the residents of the planet at those far future ages. But the other thing that caught my attention was paragraph 11, where it says one or more companies of the mortal finaliters are constantly in service on Urantia. That's 1,000
companies.
Right? A company is 1,000, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
1,000 finaliters.
Right.
And so they're saying one or more companies are now in service and constantly have been on this world. That's
amazing.
That's pretty interesting, and you know, I hadn't focused there before, that they're here now working with us with the current administration.
Yeah, that is pretty interesting. Talk about
I don't recollect
experience.
That they describe. Yeah, I don't recollect they're describing what they're doing here in other places, but maybe there are some local places.
No, I don't think so.
and again, it goes back to
speculation, and I don't think we could get it anyway, what they were doing. You know,
right.
But their experience,
we can't even
obviously
see the finaliters without them visualizing it to us in the next life. With Marantia
mm-hmm.
vision,
ah.
it's not possible to see a finaliter. I bet we can't guess what they're doing.
Yeah,
they're
I bet
salting.
We can.
They're salting us. They're
but
salting
whatever
us.
It is, it's based on what you were just talking about, and that is their experience, which is invaluable
right.
yeah. as always. In everything we ever read in this book, you know. And, of course, Jesus called it the master teacher, but, you know, it is. And that's what it's based on. It's based on their extraordinary experience.
Right.
And they're invaluable. Yes. Imagine how invaluable
yeah.
they are to
well,
everything.
I think
mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And I think
it
it's so intriguing. They refer to them as the evolutionary salt of the universe.
Yes.
So in a way, they add flavor. They add flavor
right.
to our experience.
Right.
Here, even on this planet, even now. And they're able to do that because, like you're saying, Paul, the vast range of their experience brings a flavor just to their presence, just to their very presence that has an influence. You know,
and
that just kind of like tunes everything out and makes it all more interesting. You know,
and then
gives
to
it
contemplate.
More flavor.
That they were once, that we are them in potential.
In potential,
know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a reach there. There's a reach. They're reaching
yeah.
for us, in a sense.
Yeah.
yeah.
And who would understand us better? Nobody,
mm-hmm.
really. And
yeah.
I couldn't help but, you know, paragraph 10, during the present age, the finaliters return to serve in the universes of time. I couldn't help but think of the manifesto, Lucifer's manifesto, where he's like, oh, overmuch, all of this training and overmuch preparation, only to go back and serve in the lowly.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that was one of his big arguments.
That was one of his big arguments. And yet, you know, based on the whole logic of the creation,
mm-hmm.
those
mm-hmm.
who have experience go back to serve. They are teachers ultimately. We all are. And that's the way it's set up. And that is the heart of loving service, right? That's it. That you would give back of your tremendous abilities based on your experience
mm-hmm.
to those who haven't had that yet so that you can
yeah.
help them
well,
up.
And you're always exploring while you're serving, too.
Right.
So the idea of serving in the other six super universes, to me, that sounds way cool.
Doesn't it?
Because we're going to be exploring. We're going to be seeing worlds and, you know, expressions of divine creativity that we've never even imagined. And coming from this planet, you know, to see, well, what are the struggles like? In the other super universes, you know, who knows? There's probably rebellion. There's probably evolution.
Oh, yeah.
You know, obviously evolution.
Endless permutations of
struggles is what I mean to say. There's
yeah.
all kinds of struggles going on the evolutionary
right.
world.
And
all
triumphs.
Of all these super universes. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So we can bring compassion to that. We can bring, you know, we can sort of tease out the flavor.
Amazing wisdom.
What it means
to
be an evolving creature.
Right. You know, I have to point out, friends, imagine this, the endless possibilities inherent in what they just said in this preamble to on this paper compared to we die, we go to heaven, we sit on a cloud, and we play a harp.
That would be a lot of endless harp music, wouldn't it? No, that's way too many
Well,
harps.
We don't get to do that?
We get to play a harp, but not all of us, thank God.
Are
you know, this is my vote for a bumper sticker, a musical bumper sticker. God is not a Johnny One Note.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Perfect. Yeah, Exactly. The harmony ceremony.
Mirage class.
Yeah.
Or if they even have them. Maybe they don't even have them.
It's just interesting, isn't it? The life of adventure, of service, of dynamic service, of you know, as it says, service, service, and more service, you know, adventure service,
mm-hmm.
increased service. And that's makes the whole universal mechanism tick. That's it.
Yeah.
That service, that unselfish service.
Always. It's kind of reassuring to me to read this because, you know, one of the things I've thought about is, you know, we come from this world, even here in Colorado, where we have these amazing mountains, you know, and all of the, you know, the beauty of decay and everything that goes along with being on an evolutionary world that we'll leave behind when we go to the mansion worlds. You know, when we land on the architectural spheres, everything is by design, you know, it's beautiful, it's gorgeous, there's lakes and all of that, but it's by design. It doesn't have the drama of evolutionary creation. And one kind of complements the other, I think, in the sense that what they're telling us here is, you know, enjoy those architectural worlds, but you're going to be going back out to serve again on evolutionary worlds. So you'll have all kinds of opportunities to re-engage and re-experience or, you know, rediscover and discover new forms and variations of these natural, craggy, crazy, rough, you know, evolutionary creations. I mean, that's in our future, beyond our future. And I kind of like that idea because, you know, too much of one isn't enough. You kind of need one to balance the other. And that'll be part of our experience, I think, is pretty cool. But I'm looking forward, in other words, to seeing what, you know, what the mountains and whatever else, cities, et cetera, look like on some of these other evolutionary worlds. It just
be
fascinating,
yeah.
You know, with
Absolutely.
The different mortal types and the different kinds of, who knows, everything, you know, astronomical features, geological features. It's going to really be something.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always been intrigued, and I think it's unique to us on our isolated sphere that we imagine that the universe is full of monsters, and in so much popular culture that comes out. I mean, even now, you know, it's always about lately it's about the alien ship that crashes here and plagues the world with monsters. And it used to be about the ship that traveled to other worlds and those worlds were plagued by monsters. And always we have to overcome the monsters. And it really speaks to our human fear that of the unknown. That maybe it's terrible beyond our imagination. Maybe what we have here is the best we're ever going to get. And maybe the universe is full of monsters. And quite the contrary.
Say it ain't so, sister. Say it ain't so.
Say it ain't so. Because, you know, and even I as a child got weary of that concept. And I had to imagine how that maybe the universe is at least half full of beautiful and enlightened creatures who are much better than us. And I got lost in that thought. I was 10 years old. And so point is, who among us hasn't looked at, you know, at Captain Kirk or Picard and said, wow, what a great job. I'd love to have that job where I just got to, even if there are monsters out there somewhere.
Well, you know, it's
just
really interesting. Go ahead, Paul.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, what's intriguing to me is, you know, you have media that are constantly searching for new ideas for TV shows and movies and new visions and speculating all over the place. And the furthest they've been able to get, and it always kind of, I looked at it and went, huh, you know, I wish they could make the leap And because where they are is this sense that the universe, it's like nothing more than the terrestrial spheres. You know, even if they're enlightened life, if you think there are advanced worlds, it's a very impoverished sense of a material planet with a material civilization, you know, that has
right.
maybe somehow escaped time and space and even at the furthest stretches. But what they don't do is they don't bring in this dimension of spirituality and ascension to higher and higher worlds and the idea of the goal of perfection and deity and God as the originator and the destiny. It's really unfortunate, and I think it's because religion is on some level such a taboo subject in the cultures. You know, in our TV and movies. I mean, even some of the TV shows that go there have this weird, it's all happening down here. You know, I know mm-hmm. some folks that will watch this movie, you know, show Lucifer, you know, which has all these semi-deities coming down. But they're all anthropomorphizations of human beings. You know, they're just, there isn't a sense anywhere that I can find that I see in the Urantia Revelation of higher and higher celestial spheres and a grand spiritual journey with God and spiritual values at the heart of it all, and that is what underlies the whole structure of the universe and is the whole reason it exists. You just don't see that in the media, which is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't see a marrying up of the spiritual vision of the religious traditions to you know, this whole sci-fi thing of many worlds in a populated universe. And that's one of the amazing things about the Urantia Revelation is that it integrates those different realms and presents them as unified, which is astounding.
Right.
But
right.
The
whole realm of celestial.
Leap.
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
Ahead,
I mean, I was just going to say, I totally agree. I mean, all the depictions are always of physical mortal beings, whether they're
right.
on another planet or they come from another planet or whatever.
Right.
The whole notion of invisible presence, you know, celestial beings, celestial personalities. I mean, there's the concept of angels, you know, there's that. But that seems to be growing weak. People's understanding of what that even means. So it's, you know, it used to be that people understood these things, you know, like going back to the planetary prince or even beyond. There was at least some understanding that there are invisible beings around. But we kind of lost that. And particularly the idea of benign invisible beings. And so,
right.
I totally agree. That's a conceptual. It's a conceptual piece that needs to be part of being human, is that understanding, because that's what creates the bridge to God, in a sense, that God is also an invisible person present.
You know,
and,
it seems to me the core of the whole problem is this concept of spiritual. You know,
mm-hmm.
what
mm-hmm.
is it? What is spiritual? What is that?
Yeah, or
it's real.
Mind.
But for a corporeal being, for a material being like us, we can hardly have a concept of it. We talk about it. Oh, I'm spiritual. Yeah, I'm spiritual. You know, and those of us who have read the Urantia book have probably a really decent concept of what spiritual means. But what to the average person does spiritual mean? It would be so hard for them to even put a handle on it. What does it mean? When the Urantia book says something like, the material reality is just the time-space shadow of the greater reality, which is spirit. That's so hard for a material being to grasp. So difficult. And yet, you know, and to try to describe that reality to somebody is even more difficult. We talk about it, and we agree spirit is real, but we don't really know what that means. And so
I think that's why. Yeah.
Go ahead, Chuck.
I was just going to say one of the things that Angie's come up with, come up against, in her various projects, trying to communicate ideas and spirit to people who are maybe not quite, you know, there yet, but working on it, is the lack of language. That's a huge problem. And mm-hmm. always comes up. There's no words. There's no words to talk about. The lack of language, right, because
adequate language, let's say.
A lot of the old language that's associated with religion, you know, like faith and prayer and worship, those ideas, and they're just like tossed aside, sort of a priori, because, oh, that's part of institutional religion or something. But once you do that, you're not left with any language. There's no language to talk about it. So they're part of, you know, what they've had to face is working on that specifically, you know, coming up with language. Forms and
you know, I was just
find out what words are resurfaceable. Anyway,
I was just
mm-hmm.
looking.
It's like rebuilding.
Yeah, I was
no,
just
that's
looking
true.
At.
Go ahead, Marvin. Sorry.
No. I was just looking at you know, the first few paragraphs in the book and how remarkable they are. Exactly the point you're making, Chuck. They frame a reality with a relatively few words that is an entirely new conception for our culture of reality, you know,
mm-hmm.
and here are some of these statements. It's in the second and third paragraph in paper one. The myriads of mm-hmm. planetary systems were all made to be eventually inhabited by many different types of intelligent beings. So there's the interplanetary family thing, that, you know, the Star Trek thing. But then they say, beings who could know God receive the divine affection and love him in return. And in the next paragraph, they say, the enlightened worlds all recognize and worship the universal Father, the eternal maker and infinite upholder of all creation. The will creatures of universe upon universe have embarked upon the long, long paradise journey, the fascinating struggle of the eternal adventure of attaining God the Father. The transcendent goal of the children of time is to find the eternal God, to comprehend the divine nature, to recognize the universal Father. So it's just like this grand vision right at the beginning that says, this is profoundly and in every all of its elements, the purpose is a deep spiritual purpose in relation to God, who is your source and your destiny, and mm-hmm. a journey to get to God. And all of the rest of it, in terms of the many worlds and the cultures and the civilizations, are all part of that purpose. And that's, you know, the language, what they accomplish in those first few paragraphs is really pretty stunning.
it's darn stunning.
Yeah.
When you
read it, man, my heart just swells. It swells.
Yeah.
It's never not had that effect on me, ever, from the very first moment I laid eyes on it. Those first few paragraphs of paper one thrill me to the marrow.
Mm-hmm.
The concept, and probably goes back to me as a 10-year-old child saying, there can't just be monsters in the universe everywhere. There must be something else. And I read that, and I read, you know, the very first time I laid eyes on it. No, the universe is teeming with life. Myriads of planetary systems, all made to be eventually inhabited by different types of intelligent creatures, beings who could know God. A, they have knowledge, and receive the divine affection, the ability to receive love, and the ability to love, and love him in return. They're beings like me. I have those abilities to know, to be loved, and to love in return. I do that. They're like me. We're kin. Not only are we not the only creatures in all of existence, we're just part of a grand adventure full of life and all longing. And so, you know, that's to me, spiritual nature is that longing. It's that longing for more.
Mm.
Yeah. me is spiritual. I hear
well,
an
right
echo. At,
right.
Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, I mean, talking about finality, it's like right there, right at the beginning of the book, reality is framed and the final value,
right.
In a sense, the real value of universe existence is love and knowing God.
Right. So I don't
that's
know where
it.
The
that's
echo's coming from, you guys,
everything
but
else.
Somebody
yeah,
somebody has an echo. I'm not sure where it's coming from, but maybe there's a computer on or something.
Might have been me, sorry.
Oh, no worries. Thanks, Andre.
Anyway, the love is not an afterthought. Love is not, oh, yeah, by the way, we're going to try and love each other. You know. It's
right.
Like,
no.
Oh, by the way, there's, you know, God, that, you know, whatever. You know, it's like that's up front. That's everything is referenced, organized around
yeah.
those.
Yes.
You know.
The grand motivations.
Of reality.
Yeah.
Right.
The grand
yeah.
motivations of all
it's
that
all
is true, beautiful, and good.
Statement.
Right.
Yeah. I'm so glad you read that, Mark. That was really helpful. Really paints a picture.
Well, yeah, I think that bottom line, it's probably got to be one of the main reasons they've given us this revelation at this period of time, is because that integrated picture of both a populated universe but a profoundly spiritual cosmos where there's a higher celestial journey that is above and beyond our sensing on a material level. That integrated view of reality on multiple levels that is, you know, the word in theology is teleological. It's going to the ultimate purpose of God, God's nature, God's perfection, loving God, being in relationship with God. And that's what drives and patterns the entire creation. That integrated vision is what our culture and our world so desperately needs in the centuries out ahead. And I just
mm-hmm.
think it's, you know, we've been given this amazing revelation that accomplishes the conveying of that vision. And like you say, Chuck, that, you know, what Angie's struggling with and so many of us are struggling with is how do we convey it to our fellows who are struggling,
right.
searching and hungry? And you know, and this revelation has given it to us and left us with the challenge of developing the intervening language and the culture, you know,
mm-hmm.
over
mm-hmm.
a long period, over some period of time.
Yeah.
And it's you scratch your head and say, golly, how do we do this? But they've sure given us an amazing set of tools to make the effort.
Yeah, and it's through the effort that we learn how to do it. It's like
yeah.
everything else, trial and error. You know, well, that didn't work very good. Let me try something else here.
uh-huh.
She never gave
uh-huh.
up.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just keep trying because it's so important for everybody to have that peace and that understanding that, A, life is eternal, that, B, the universe is full of, you know, mercy and goodness and beauty and truth, that we live in a friendly and well-ordered universe, and we're not alone. We're not alone.
Mm.
We're not cosmic orphans. We are loved.
There are a couple of
we have value.
I could just point out a couple of other things from our reading here that I think are interesting. In paragraph 9, where they point out that they talk about our working associations. The Corps is organized in accordance with the working associations of the world of space. So, meaning our cohorts throughout our ascension experience that we're going to still be associated some way in this future service,
mm.
I think is sort of maybe what they're saying, in keeping with the associative experience acquired throughout the long and eventful ascendant career. So
teamwork.
That's really interesting. Yeah, yeah. It kind of reframes my experience even now, you know.
mm-hmm.
As
right.
we engage in our eventful ascendant career, we're going to have associations. Just like we do doing this radio show, and that these associations conceivably will have value in our finality or career, I think is pretty interesting. And then they say that even though ascended creatures are admitted in equality, in no way does this abrogate individuality or destroy personal identity? So they're almost saying that our individuality and individual identity and our experience that goes along with that are part of the value that we bring.
Absolutely.
That we bring to this teamwork. So that's, I like that as well.
We don't become homogenated at some point where,
right,
you know, we
right,
have unity
right.
of purpose,
not,
unity of goal, but
mm-hmm.
not
mm-hmm.
unity of
mm-hmm.
experience.
Yeah.
We could never have that.
Yeah. Anyway, I just thought those were worth pointing out that in terms of how this future role is going to be characterized, you know, we're still maybe in association with people we've known through our Ascended career, and that everything we've developed in terms of our individual abilities will be, you know, will be a contribution to that.
I thought that the end of that paragraph was interesting too,
yeah.
Chuck, because they say we can immediately discern in communicating with the Penaliter whether he is an ascendant mortal, a Havona native, adopted seraphim, midway creature, or material son. That's like saying, well, I can immediately tell you're from New York.
It's like we have an accent or something.
Yeah, right.
Oh, he's got a mortal accent.
Right. It's interesting that they threw that in there, you know. You retain your uniqueness and even the place that you came from.
Kind of endearing, actually.
It is endearing. That's a great description. I want to say, Marvin, that Isadora on the board, when you went on about, you know, our popular culture and media and stuff and how, you know, they don't ever cover the fact of, you know, the reality of the spirit. Isadora said, somebody needs to make that movie, Marvin. And she said, Avatar hardly came close. And it was pretty good, but you're right. It's always about material struggles. It's never about the multi-level, to quote a friend, Troy Bishop, universes that, you know, that go deeper and deeper into spiritual reality and less material reality.
You know, you have a genius like James Cameron who can take the culture, you know, who did Avatar, and he can take the culture out as far as it can go. And it's got to be one of my very favorite films. I've watched it so many times. Yeah, because it does that, you know, and it does it with a feminine vision of spirit, which is just gorgeous. And I think he takes that in the sequels. He's going to take it further. But you know, it's so achingly close to that place where you also depict that massive numbers of worlds have this common quest of the spiritual search, you know, and that it's threaded throughout the universe and that it's where everything is going. But then what I think I fail to see, because there's such little information, is any sophisticated sense of the afterlife and the ascension career, the journey that they describe so amazingly in this revelation,
mm-hmm.
you just
right.
don't see that in the media. It's like the harps on clouds, you know. It's
right.
it's a very simplistic endpoint, you know, which is not at all what's going on, and it makes no sense. It doesn't feel right, and so it's, you know, it's kind of like, oh, what a, kind of a letdown, you know. But that's what the whole thing is about, even at its highest conception. So you know. Eventually, there will be, I think, cultural leaders and filmmakers, real geniuses in their realms, who will take this vision and bring it into play. But I think it's waiting out ahead a bit.
Won't that be grand?
Yeah,
I
yeah.
think it will be. I think it will be grand that this will launch a million ships of exploration
mm-hmm.
and discovery and creativity. And more
mm-hmm.
beyond our wildest imagination. Well, shall we read at least section one on the Havona natives and just get a sense about the?
I think we should.
One of these groups.
Yeah.
One of these groups of Penaliters. I want to share a little memory of Andre years and years ago. We were in study group. And, oh, gosh, it had to have been, I don't know, 1981 maybe. And we were talking about phenaliters. And I admitted to the group that before I knew how to pronounce that, I said finaliters.
Yeah, me
and
too.
And Andre said, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
And I always remember that, Andre. You know, for me,
Some people still pronounce it finaliters. Yeah.
Finaliters, yeah. We were the finaliters. And both have meaning, I guess. And being, you know, not ever having had anybody pronounce it for me, that's what I naturally wanted to say. That was my natural inclination. So, anyway.
Well, they're not to be confused with the Zippo lighters or the piezoelectric lighters either.
Right.
Shouldn't be
no,
confused
we're final,
with those.
The final lighters.
The final lighters, yeah.
Yeah, right. Just a little trivia, guys. It's been fun studying with all of you for so many years. What a gas.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean,
our first
study groups together were with, you know, Jim and Roxanne Andrews and with Jim and Joanne Brummett.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And back in the day. And the McNellys.
And the McNellys, yeah.
Yeah.
At the North
Boulder
Glen group.
Scene was pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Pretty awesome. The Denver Boulder scene back then.
Yeah.
Okay. So who wants to read the Havona Natives?
I'd be glad to.
Okay, cool.
I'd be even gladder if I had that right in front of me, and I'll have it in a sec, in a gif.
In a gif.
My computer will oblige me. There we go, the Havona Natives. And, yeah, we've got a little rustling still in the back. Many of the Havona natives who serve as teachers in the pilgrim training schools of the Central Universe become greatly attached to the ascending mortals and still more intrigued with the future work and destiny of the Corps of Mortal Finaliters. On Paradise, there is maintained, at the administrative headquarters of the Corps, a registry for Havona volunteers presided over by the Associate of Grand Fonda. Today, you will find millions upon millions of Havona natives upon this waiting list. These perfect beings of direct and divine creation are of great assistance to the mortal core of finality, and they will undoubtedly be of even greater service in the far distant future. They provide the viewpoint of one born in perfection and divine repleteness. The finaliters thus embrace both phases of experiential existence, perfect and perfected. Havona natives must achieve certain experiential developments in liaison with evolutionary beings, which will create reception capacity for the bestowal of a fragment of the spirit of the Universal Father. The mortal finaliter corps has as permanent members only such beings as have been fused with the spirit of the first source and center, or who, like the gravity messengers, innately embody the spirit of God the Father. The inhabitants of the Central Universe are received into the core in the ratio of 1 in 1,000, a finaliter company. The Corps is organized for temporary service in companies of 1,000. The ascended creatures, numbering 997, to one Havona native and one gravity messenger. Finaliters are thus mobilized in companies, but the finality oath is administered individually. It is an oath of sweeping implications and eternal import. The Havona native takes the same oath and becomes forever attached to the core. The Havona recruits follow the company of their assignment. Wherever the group goes, they go. And you should see their enthusiasm in the new work of the finaliters. The possibility of attaining the core of the finality is one of the superb thrills of Havona. The possibility of becoming a finaliter is one of the supreme adventures of these perfect races.
The Hamona natives are also received in the same ratio into the core of conjoint Trinitized finaliters on Vice Charrington and into the core of transcendental finaliters on Paradise. The Hamona citizens regard these three destinies as constituting the supreme goals of their supernal careers, together with their possible admission to the core of Hamona finaliters.
Mm-hmm. And so here they are, the permanent
residents. Five short paragraphs. Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding.
So that last paragraph seems to introduce a whole bunch of new possibilities, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe unless I'm misunderstanding, there's now, in addition to the core of mortal finality, there's cores of conjoint trinitized finaliters. I don't recollect anywhere that they really tell us what that might refer to. And also core of transcendental finaliters. And then also a core of Hamona finaliters, which the implication is that that's a core of 1,000 made up of Hamona natives. I don't know if you get that, but that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
these are three additional things.
Or some combination.
Any detail about.
Yeah. Well, they do flesh that out a little bit more in another place where they talk about a couple of the other core. I'll go ahead and the core of the something Sons of Destiny is what I'm remembering as another one of them. And it may be actually at the end of this paper, or it could be where they're talking about the Trinitized Sons, but I'll look.
Yeah, anyway, so that was interesting. And then I'm just going back to paragraph 3, where they say 997. So 997 mortals, ascending mortals, and then each of these core has one Hamona native and one gravity.
Not just mortals, ascenders, because angels could be in there too, and midwayers, and material sons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Ascendant creatures, yeah, numbering 9.
Yeah, we'll
okay.
see that
yeah.
in the next few sections.
Okay.
So in other words,
but
the Hamona native is... Yeah.
Go ahead, Paula.
Well, the Hamona native is the one that's the permanent resident of Paradise. You know, he has the house by the side of the road. Everybody, you know, comes through there. The gravity messenger.
The way I've been thinking of it, well, these many years, but it's obviously open to, there's a constant possibility of new understanding, is I thought it was 990, mostly mortal ascenders, 997, then Hamona native, one gravity messenger, and that leaves one more position in each company, which I thought was either an Adam or a midway creature, an angelic.
That's for the Evangel of Light. That's for the Evangel of Light, which is mentioned a little later in the paper.
Oh, okay.
Okay, yeah. that's the 100th or the 1,000th.
1,000th, yeah.
Member, okay.
And right now it's just temporarily filled. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The Evangel of Light, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was intrigued by the fact that, you know, and not necessarily intrigued. I mean, I just love the way the consistency of the Urantia book points out that the finaliters thus embrace both phases of experiential existence, perfect and perfected.
Yeah.
You know, because they mention the Hamona natives in other places and say that in some ways they're envious of us, our journey.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the universes to Hamona.
But they do talk about the future partnering that's going to go on, that there's a divine synergy of complementary nature between evolved perfection and creative perfection.
Right.
So this is apparently part of that. I mean, I saw that in another section. I forget where it was now, but they talked about, you know, future destinies of somehow we're going to collaborate with these Hmong natives in various ways, which is kind of exciting because it means that they fulfill their purpose and we fulfill our purpose in partnership in some unimaginable way that creates outcomes that nobody could, you know, those super additive outcomes they always talk about.
Right.
So that's going to be, you know, it's kind of fascinating and mysterious.
And we talked about... No, go ahead. Sorry.
Just real quick, I thought it was interesting that they mentioned this oath that we take and they take. The finality oath, they say, is administered individually. An oath of sweeping implications and eternal import. I can only imagine. The Hmong natives take the same oath and become forever attached to the core. So that's interesting. That kind of joins us in a way, taking the same oath.
Yeah.
It's kind of the key to that complemental connection that we're going to have, maybe.
One of the best topical study groups I ever was in was one that Terry Kruger did on the taking of oaths and how often that happens to us in our career, where we are asked to make a promise, to take an oath, you know? And I just, it really impacted me. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's such value in it that it's done all through creation, all along the way, at different milestones, where you then again promise, once again promise, make a promise, which is essentially what an oath is, to do something in a certain way. With a certain amount of integrity and, you know, commitment. Very powerful.
Yeah. By the way, you know, to Marvin's point about the various core, you know, the four that are mentioned right there, I'm not sure where they mentioned some of the other ones elsewhere, but where they mention them all together is in paper 30, where they're talking about all the different personality types, and they're essentially a paper full of lists in the first part of it. And so in paper 30, section 2, paragraphs 131 to 138, it lists them. Well, let me just read the preamble to it. Composite personality groups. There are on Uversa the records of numerous additional groups of intelligent beings that are also closely related to the organization and administration of the grand universe. Among such orders are the following three composite personality groups. And the first one they mention is the paradise core of the finality. One, the core of mortal finaliters. Two, the core of paradise finaliters. Three, the core of trinitized finaliters. Four, the core of conjoint trinitized finaliters, which is what Marvin read. Five, the core of Havona finaliters again. Six, the core of transcendental finaliters again. That's what Marvin referred to. And seven, the one that I partly remembered, the core of unrevealed sons of destiny. So all of these finaliter core are being gathered and marshaled and further trained and experientialized for, we can only wonder what. You wonder, if they're all finaliters, are they all destined also to that first outer space level, dealing with various aspects of how the ultimate will be actualized out there? So.
And the fact that there are seven is interesting, right? Wasn't there seven, Andre?
Seven, yeah.
Seven
again.
Ones.
Boy, that number seven comes up a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it always speaks to me of supremacy, like Chuck was pointing out, you know, the completion of the seven super universes and the experience in each one. And, you know, that completeness.
Well, in this case, more ultimacy. Because it's those from the first universe age, the paradise finaliters, the Havona finaliters, from the second universe age, the mortal finaliters, and those that really pertain to a future universe age, the conjoint trinitized finaliters, the transcendental finaliters who are really both pre-second age and post-second age, because, you know, they certainly exist, you know, in on paradise, but they're having to do with that which is above the finite. They are not finite beings, those transcendentalers. So that the implication is that there's a finality core for the transcendentalers. One can only wonder what that's about.
Wow. Talk about multiple levels.
Yeah.
Your adventure book is such an onion that way. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you just peel back one layer. And I always like to tell people one paragraph can be a universe of thought, you know, and it's so true. It's why we so enjoy studying it, because we can speculate endlessly and, you know, and find such meaning and depth there. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just,
brain stretches.
Yeah.
I just was skipping ahead a little, and there's one of the first paragraph in section three actually lists, gives us a sense of the proportions in these finality companies, which was the question I had. Should I go ahead and read it?
Well, sure.
It's a jump ahead.
We said we were going to do that.
We'll read it.
Backwards
anyway.
And forwards.
Yes, it says, ascendant adjuster-fused mortals compose the bulk of the primary core of the finality, together with the adopted and glorified seraphim. They usually constitute 990 in each finaliter company. The proportion
together
of mortals... Yeah. The proportion of mortals and angels in any one group varies, though the mortals far outnumber the seraphim. But still, that leaves room for, in that 990, substantial numbers of seraphim, right, is how I read it. The Havona natives, glorified material sons, glorified midway creatures, the gravity messengers, and the unknown and missing member make up only 1% of the core. Each company of 1,000 finaliters has places for just 10 of these non-mortal and non-seraphic personalities. Interesting.
So, how did they get from 1% to 10%? Oh, no, that would be 1% of 1,000. Got it. Never mind.
Yeah, 10 is 100%.
I wanted to point out, too. Go ahead, Marvin, finish your thought.
It's just a new impression for me that I always thought that the large bulk, well, it is, the mortals far outnumber the seraphim. But still, I hadn't realized that the 990 could be a substantial number of seraphim, which is wonderful.
Yeah. That is wonderful. Yeah. Our ever-present partners throughout the ascension. You know?
Go ahead, Paula. You were going to share something.
Well, that we pointed out in last week and in previous weeks, this benefit of the stationary personalities, you know, the ones that hold the fort down. And certainly the Havona natives are that. You know, they play that role too. So it's interesting that just one, though, in the core of 1,000, and that they hold that as being the ultimate. You know, to have gotten there, yay! That's the goal, to one of those cores. So even they have a form of ascension. You know. Even though they're perfect,
you should see there's
an achievement. Yeah, you should see it. I love the way you read that, Andre.
You should
it was
see
great.
Their enthusiasm.
These perfect beings, You know,
again,
we can hardly imagine.
Very endearing.
Yeah,
very endearing.
Right.
Well, I'm sure we're going to be astonished, you know, the day we set foot in Havona to set foot. I mean, just this one aspect, okay, where third stage spirit beings, we set foot, whatever our foot is like at that point, you know, we rest upon, we wake up from our
we land, seccharific,
long journey, probably of hundreds of years, you know, from the center of Orvontan to the seventh circuit of Havona. And imagine the implication when we get up and we first touch the surface of our pilot world of Havona, of that seventh circuit, and we realize we are standing on something that has always existed.
Mm.
It never had a beginning. Mm. It has always been there. We are encountering realities for the first time in our life in a total that have always been there. We may have encountered many beings up to that point that have always existed in the super universes, but now we are in a place that has always existed.
Hmm.
That's just astounding.
That is astounding.
Yeah. Well, you know, when part of what that includes, I just came across this yesterday, it includes the prototype for us. Well, here,
yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Right.
Short sentence.
Pattern.
All beings in all universes are fashioned along the lines of some one order of pattern creature living on some one of the billion worlds of Havona. Even the mortals of time have their goal and ideals of creature existence on the outer circuits of these pattern spheres on high. So the thought that we're going to encounter pretty early on ideal, perfect versions of what we are, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can't even imagine what that's going to be like. What you're saying, Andre, about that being rooted in eternity is just
it's a remarkable concept.
I think it really
is.
True. Yeah.
What's the citation again?
That line is 14:4:18.
14:4:18.
Section 4, paragraph 18.
And doesn't it say somewhere that Michael and the Creative Mother kind of go through those pattern worlds and pick out various patterns for, you know, the Creator Sons They go shopping. Yeah, they're doing their... They're looking for their patterns for their local creation.
Well, think about it. The 10,000 systems... You know, they correspond to each is patterned probably after just one Havona world.
Mm-hmm.
And how they pick and choose among the billion Havona worlds, if all the Creator Sons in a super universe pick, you know, their 10,000 differently, and one would only wonder why they would not pick them differently, then...
Right.
You have the billion worlds of Havona being essentially replicated in the worlds of a local system. You know, somehow each being little fragments imperfectly of what that Havona world is representing that system. At least there's that correspondence. So one can only wonder that that's not part of the pattern.
Well, you guys, we're down to our last minute. I just, always have to say how much fun it is to romance the universe with all of you. And thank you to all of our listeners. We got a good start on this paper, I think. I'm definitely up for next week, The Gravity Messengers. So if you want to read ahead like Marvin.
And we're sorry to anybody that wasn't able to get on the chat. I did also see that Diane had called in, and maybe she was going to tell us about that. I don't know. But there was nobody on the chat, which is highly unusual. It makes me suspect there was a problem. So sorry about that.
Huh.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I saw the chat the whole time, but...
Well, I did too, but there's nobody else on it besides us.
Oh, okay. Okay. Huh.
Yeah.
All right, then.
Well,
until
next
week.
We'll
figure it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Until
good
next
to be
week,
with you
friends.
All.
Always.
Yeah.
Thank
wow.
you.
Yeah. Wonderful conversation.
Yeah, it was.
Fun.
Thrilling. Okay.
All
love
right.
You.
Well, have a great week, everybody.
Bye.
You too.
You too.
Yeah.
Bye for now. And prayers to the Triennial Delegate Assembly.
Right.
Oh,
going
yeah.
on now.
Who are meeting right now.
Upstairs.
Yep.
I got one of them upstairs.
Oh, there you go.
Okay, love you guys.
Love you too. Bye for now.
Love you. Bye.
Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.